Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio, this is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Alex Hoyer. In 1972, Martin McNally hijacked American Airlines Flight 119 out of St. Louis. He drew inspiration from the notorious D.B. Cooper, who had hijacked a plane just a few months prior and was never heard from again. There's a new documentary film called American Skyjacker that details McNally's brazen hijacking and his attempts to escape from federal prison. The film premieres in St. Louis this Friday at Ronnie's Cinema in South St. Louis County and will begin streaming next month. In a moment, I'll talk with the film's co-director and co-writer, but I'm first joined by Danny Wisentowski. Danny is one of the producers of this show, but before he joined St. Louis Public Radio, he wrote a 2017 cover story for the Riverfront Times titled The Final Flight of Martin McNally. That story inspired a 2020 podcast, which then inspired the film. That film features reenactments of what happened and a lot of people with firsthand experience, including Martin McNally, who is now 81 years old. The film also features Danny, and Danny is here with us now. Danny, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Alex.
The 1960s, the late 1960s, and the early 1970s were described as the golden age of hijacking. Why?
This was a combination of where the technology of air travel, it had finally reached the point where regular families, working class people, this was not luxury, and it's hard to imagine the impact of allowing people to travel across the country. Some of our greatest movements in this country, the tensions, the conflicts, are when people pick up and move to go to a better place, look for better work. But a lot of what happens in the 60s is you get this crunch of this incredible opportunity of taking down an aircraft. It's like taking down a stagecoach or robbing a bank, but it is almost even more valuable to criminals and opportunists. And at this point, these airports and airlines are just not prepared for the security needs and the kind of inventive opportunism of criminals who otherwise might have just been robbing a place for a couple thousand dollars. Now, there was a model to rip off maybe the biggest score that any of these criminals could imagine.
Give us a sense of about how many of these hijacking attempts there were back then.
I mean, we're talking about dozens. We're talking about another hijacking case almost every few weeks. This was a regular part of the news coverage. And in looking back at this era, you see this complicated balance of this is exciting, this is unusual, this is dramatic, this is great for the different news organizations that are sending their reporters. But this is also starting to really impact regular people and airlines as well. Again, they're not yet willing to embrace security, but they're telling their stewardesses, like, hey, prepare the crew and passengers if they make an unscheduled stop to Cuba. Do whatever the hijackers want. And so this golden age is a period of where the law has not caught up fast enough. Society is still not sure if this is just something exciting or serious. And the level of danger is still not compelling to make the changes that we eventually will see in all of our modern airports. Things like, you know, metal detectors, security. This does not exist in the golden age of hijacking.
I mentioned in the introduction that Martin McNally was inspired by D.B. Cooper in 1971. Why was McNally so convinced that hijacking a plane was the thing to do instead of robbing a bank?
D.B. Cooper's case, you know, which happens again only a few months before McNally does this in June of 1972 here in St. Louis, but this case is so blatant, and it is so successful for a single act for someone to steal over $200,000 to take command of a plane. And part of it is this realization, as the investigators and police can't find this man, D.B. Cooper, which is not even his real name. It's the best description and name that he gave. And people start to realize that if you can get away with this, every plane in the sky is a potential target. Every terminal, every gate. And it just takes someone who is bold enough, because the decision to accept that ransom, that is happening between the pilot, these banks, And there is just this, I think, a sense that McNally had, and he is not the only one. I think he's around one of about a dozen of people who have just enough technical know-how and a lot of confidence who think, I can jump out of a plane with a bag of money and survive.
Why did he pick a plane that was going out of St. Louis's airport?
St. Louis was notable at this point because its airlines, and especially American Airlines, believed that metal detectors, security, this was bad for passengers. This was infringing on the rights and freedom and the promise of luxurious, casual air travel wherever you wanted to go. And as we explore in the film, the very day of this hijacking, the head of American Airlines was telling a Post-Dispatch reporter, we don't want metal detectors here. Who would even hijack a plane in St. Louis? Mm. And so it really, this sense of invulnerability, perhaps, but also the idea that these were crimes that only big cities dealt with, it just created more openings for people like Martin McNally.
That St. Louis Post-Dispatch journalist is Bill Freivogel, who's in the film, who listeners may recognize as one of our Legal Roundtable guests. How does the hijacking play out? So the plane is in the air, and it's going to Omaha, mm-hmm. I think. So what happens?
You know, like a lot of other hijackings, McNally has smuggled on board a number of weapons. He's disguised. He is just sitting there. He is working on his note. He eventually gives a stewardess this note. He gives her the carbon copy instead of the real one, which is, kind of this gray, it's not very easy to read. So this is not a smooth hijacking. This is not Mission Impossible or James Bond. Things are clumsy. McNally has never parachuted before. He has no experience flying a plane. He has some experience from being in the Navy, but none of that involved armed combat or certainly something like taking over a passenger plane. But he does do this. He has a weapon. He also claims that he has grenades or bombs on this plane. He has various threats that he uses to take control. And, eventually, at this point, stewardesses and flight crews were instructed to basically follow the instructions. They had euphemisms to tell the passengers. They had tactics to try to calm people down. There was a great deal of worry because even after D.B. Cooper, there had not been a terrible shootout. There had not been a plane exploding. And the efforts were, let's make these incidents as small and containable crimes and not into terrible tragedies.
Hmm. So the pilot or the flight crew comes on the intercom and they say, we have a guest who wants to return to St. Louis. The plane lands in St. Louis. And there's some negotiation back and forth. He wants some parachutes. He wants $502,000.
It's a very particular dollar amount, yeah.
Yes, very, very particular, which is significantly more than what D.B. Cooper asked for. The news is covering this, and there is downtime as they seek to get the money, the parachutes. And while this news coverage is unfolding on television, there is a man at a bar near the airport who is watching what is going on, and he wants to take matters into his own hands. What does he do, Danny?
This guy, David Hanley, he, through circumstances that are still not confirmed, even David Hanley himself later said that he didn't fully remember why he did what he did, but he gets in his Cadillac. He drives it through the fence of the airport, right through onto the tarmac, onto where these waiting planes are, where the FBI snipers and various folks are now observing this plane, and he drives it right toward the nose wheels of this aircraft and collides with it, and horribly injures himself and disables the plane that has fuel in it, that is getting ready to take off to complete Martin McNally's hijacking. This throws this entire sequence into even more chaos. No one fully at that point knows why this is happening. McNally doesn't know, certainly. But somehow this does not completely derail the hijacking.
They just get to a new plane.
They just get to a new plane. And David Hanley is eventually arrested and recovered. And, eventually there's different claims of whether he'd been drinking, whether he'd been listening to the radio broadcast. But something about these crimes, this is just an incredible example, like D.B. Cooper inspired Martin McNally to think, I want to be in the spotlight. I want to be the one to take this money and to make this work. These crimes also, in a weird way, inspired David Hanley, who wanted to be a hero and who, you know, was happened to be at the right place at the right time to try to, you know, become, you know, to turn the story in a different way. And that certainly did not work out well for him.
So Martin McNally gets in a new plane. By this time, he's released most of the passengers. There are still some on board, as well as the flight crew. Although he releases a couple of the flight attendants as well. So he has the money, the $502,000. He has a parachute. The plane takes off, and he says he wants to go to somewhere in Canada, but he has no intention of ever landing in Canada because he's going to jump out the back of the plane down the steps. And so the plane is in the air, and he wants to jump somewhere near Michigan, I think it is, but he ends up jumping around a town called Peru, Indiana. And you mentioned earlier that he had never used a parachute before, and when he jumps out, he opens the parachute, but he has some trouble with it, and he gets injured, and then he lands. What happens after he lands?
Well, what doesn't happen is him landing safely with the money, because the bag of money detaches midair, and this $500,000, which is real, you know, that was real money. This was an actual effort by the FBI and a very, you know, to get that amount of money on I think it was a weekend or late at night. He drops that money on the way down because he is not an experienced parachutist, and he added this great second, you know, thing attached to his body that was not well balanced or attached. So he lands in Peru, Indiana, where is also a place that he did not want to be. He was trying to jump near his home in Detroit. And so he was trying to time this jump. He was counting on having some light. But of course, David Hanley and that Cadillac meant that this entire incident was now hours out of schedule, happening late at night. Martin McNally was really afraid that he was about to jump into Lake Michigan when he jumped out of that plane. He could not see the ground. He did not really know where he was. He eventually, though, lands in Peru, Indiana, which is in the middle of a manhunt for the hijacker. The FBI, as I later discovered, they had agents in trailing planes. They were very closely trying to follow this and to figure out where it actually was going. And so they were not tricked by this plane going to Canada. They knew where he jumped, and they knew where around the area he'd land. The bag of money was found by a soybean farmer who returned it. A very kind of entertaining side part of this story of what do you do if you're out there, if you find $500,000
in a bag? Just give it to the government.
Absolutely. You could question his decisions on that, but he seemed very pleased with it. He got his own, you know, 15 minutes of fame. But McNally does eventually, through a series of strange events that we explore, he manages to get a ride back to Detroit, where, though, the FBI is basically already waiting for him.
I'm talking with Danny Wisentowski, a producer for this show. His reporting prior to joining STLPR served as the inspiration for a 2020 podcast about Martin McNally's 1972 hijacking, and it is now a new documentary film called American Skyjacker. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll continue my conversation with Danny, and we'll talk with the co-director and co-writer of American Skyjacker. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
Welcome back. I'm Alex Hoyer. We're talking about the new film American Skyjacker, which details the story of Martin McNally. McNally hijacked an American Airlines flight that took off from St. Louis in 1972. The film was inspired by journalist Danny Wisentowski's Riverfront Times cover story about McNally that he wrote in 2017. American Skyjacker, the film, was co-directed and co-written by Eli Corris and Josh Schaefer, and Eli Corris joins me now. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Hi, great to be with you.
Eli, I want to get to more of McNally's story in a bit, including his attempted escapes from federal prison. But first, take us back. What was it about Danny's story that inspired the 2020 podcast and now the film?
It was Danny's story more than anything. There was app called the Longform app many years ago, and I would peruse it with my writing partner, Josh, looking for incredible stories. And we came across The Final Flight of Martin McNally and read it with glee and contacted Danny with hopes of adapting it into a script. And so we started that process, which is a very long, arduous process in Hollywood. And in the midst of that, this is about early 2019, Danny told me that Mac was living in St. Louis and would be willing to speak with us. And I was like, let's get a crew together and get this guy on tape just for posterity's sake. You know, it's living history. And so that's what we did in late March of 2019. And then suddenly we realized we had a documentary on our hands after spending 4 days with McNally, getting his whole story on tape, multi-camera angles, and started trying to put it together as a documentary. And then after trying to get that financed, somebody came along, Imperative Entertainment, said, we love the story. We are starting a podcast division. Would you just like to make it as a podcast? Which was music to our ears, because so many times when you sell a script in Hollywood, you get the money and it's great and it's an honor and there's a lot of excitement, and then everything just languishes and nothing gets made. And that had happened to us time and time again. And so we could finally tell our story through a podcast, which we kind of made more of a radio play from beginning to end.
I mentioned in the introduction of this conversation that the film includes reenactments, and one that really caught my attention was the man who drove his car into the plane, and then another was of Martin McNally, not the 81-year-old Martin McNally, but an actor jumping out of the back of a plane to recreate that. Can you walk us through what went into those scenes? They seem fairly complicated.
Yeah, you know, we made the decision very early on to embrace the recree. There seems to be some rule out there where you don't want to see faces. You only want to see chins and mouths and hands and rack focusing. And we threw that out the window in the second shot. And it was either you're with us or you're not with us. As far as the guy crashing into the plane, David Hanley, that's actually one of the co-producers on the film, because he looked the most like David Hanley when we were casting. We held the picture up beside him and we're like, oh my God, you're a dead ringer. You're going to have to do this. And so we, you know, we're on a lower budget, but we had access to a plane and a runway, which was a big get for the whole movie, and an old Cadillac as well. And so we just used the movie magic editing to make it seem like it really happened, as well as great archive that we had access to. As far as the back of the plane, finding a plane in Southern California, where we shot the vast majority of the recrees, that has a back staircase was challenging, but there happened to be a couple of them. The first one we found was actually at the Ontario International Airport, but ironically, due to heavy security, we had a very difficult time booking it and using it. But we found another plane that actually had a back staircase at a place called Skydive Paris, which was a skydiving school and had a full private airport. And it served a lot of purposes for us. We were able to not only have the back of a plane to have a guy jump out of, or fake jump out of, but we also had a skydiving team that we could suddenly access.
Well, I think that really made the film sing, to be able to see how that might have occurred. And so I thought that that was a great part of the film. Kudos to you and your crew there.
Thank you.
Danny, Martin McNally received a lifetime prison sentence for what he did. He was first sent to a prison in Kansas, but then he was sent to a prison in Marion, Illinois. But he always wanted to escape from prison, and then he tried a couple times. Tell us about the attempted prison escape from Marion.
You know, as you say, he made or planned multiple escape attempts, both in Leavenworth in Kansas and in Marion. He became kind of an expert on the challenges that this involved, understanding where the guards are, understanding where the towers are. Are they going to build another tower? How much time do you have? All of these kind of came together, but what really happens is he collaborates with another convicted skyjacker who was also serving a life sentence, a man named Garrett Trapnell. And through a series of events, Garrett Trapnell was able to get another ally on the outside, a woman named Barbara Oswald. Barbara Oswald, in turn, to help these two guys escape from prison. And I know these are a lot of steps, and there's even more. Barbara Oswald hijacks a helicopter and forces that helicopter pilot to fly to the prison with the idea of picking up a few prisoners and making this escape. This entire escape plan falls apart when that helicopter pilot, a man named Alan Barklage, shoots and kills, tragically, Barbara Oswald in that helicopter. And Barbara tragically dies in this, and the film really gets into why she did what she did, what were her motivations that we can understand, and the way that she was, frankly, very manipulated and used by these experienced criminals to get what they wanted.
And then, shockingly to me, as someone who was watching the film and who was familiar with your story, Barbara Oswald's daughter, Robin Oswald, later on attempts to hijack a plane to again free Garrett Trapnell.
It's a really it's a stranger than fiction development, and it really both is unbelievable, and though it is true, but again, it shows just how destructive Garrett Trapnell and Martin McNally as a team, they destroyed this family, which is the way that Martin McNally describes it now. When I first spoke with him, one of the first pieces of this was his great regret and his hope to acknowledge what had happened to Barbara Oswald and her daughter. That was really the core, I think, of why he finally wanted to talk about this case after so many years.
And near the end of the film, McNally expresses that remorse that you mentioned, and he shared this same sentiment in a recent interview with you, Danny.
The story needs to be told while some of these people are still alive. My original intention was to rehabilitate Barbara Oswald and her daughter, because both of them were scammed. And they were not criminally inclined. And we were monsters. We were monsters for even bringing them into our life. And, we destroyed the Oswald family who lived in St. Louis. That's regrettable, no question about it.
That's Martin McNally talking with Danny Wisentowski just a few days ago. Eli, we hear McNally's remorse for how his actions impacted the Oswald family, but did you sense that he was remorseful for the 1972 hijacking?
Oh, absolutely. I think he looks back at a life wasted to a certain extent. You know, I think he also recognizes, though, that his story is something of a unicorn and is unlike any other. And I think he also recognizes that he is kind of living history right now. But at the end of the day, yeah, I think he would, if he had it to do over again, he never would have done it.
Yeah. We're going to move forward in time now. Despite the lifetime sentence, McNally received parole in 2019. And of all places, he chose St. Louis to live, even though he had no family connections here. But through a criminal justice ministry, he was able to get a South City apartment. Danny, he told you what Martin McNally did a few days ago about why he came to St. Louis.
Intentions were to stay in St. Louis for maybe a month or so, just to get things squared away and buy a car and get some weapons and everything. And I was going to go out robbing banks. And I know how to rob the vaults. I know how to get the vaults. I won't tell you how, because that wouldn't be good. But after a month or so, I was told that I qualified for a military pension. And it's been nice every month since then. This military pension keeps me out of bank vaults. So that's good. That's saving the banks a lot of money, probably. That's what I was planning to do. I'm glad that it never materialized, because I'm sure I would have wound up back in prison without any question or hesitation on that.
That's Martin McNally talking with Danny Wisentowski a few days ago. We only have just a bit of time left, but one thing at the end of the film is all of you get on a plane with Martin McNally, but he was unsure of whether he would be on the no-fly list. You think that somebody who hijacked a plane might be on that list, but remarkably, he is able to fly. Eli, in about 30 seconds, what was that like?
The film, it's very brief, because we couldn't really dramatize it as much as we do at the end of the podcast. But, and I don't know if Danny remembers this, but we stopped on the tarmac for about 30 minutes with no explanation. And the rest of the crew was texting me, freaking out. I was sitting on the plane as well, obviously, thinking we were about to get raided by the police and pulled off the plane, but that did not happen. So it was more dramatic than it will seem in the film, in real life.
What was that like for you, Danny?
Mac was really worried, and you're right. There was no way for him to know whether he could fly or not. It's not something that they let you know about, and it just goes to show how much history has left behind people like him after 9/11, after the way that airline security has been shaped. But it was because of criminals like Martin McNally and D.B. Cooper that defined the shape of our air travel for generations.
Danny Wisentowski is a journalist whose reporting inspired the podcast and film about Martin McNally. He's also a producer for this show. Thanks, Danny.
Great to be here.
And Eli Corus is the co-director and co-writer of American Skyjacker. It has its St. Louis theatrical premiere this Friday at Ronnie's Cinema in South St. Louis County, and it'll be available for streaming in mid-November. Thanks for being here, Eli.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode was produced by Olivia Mizell.
Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.